Hi, and welcome to Thinking Out Loud. This is Mariana.
And Elizabeth. How's it going?
Good. I am very jealous, very, very jealous of you.
Why?
Well, okay, so it's a Monday, and we don't usually record on a Monday.
Right.
And the reason we're recording on a Monday and not a Thursday happy hour or a Friday morning is because...
Because I went to Santa Rosa, and I holed up in a hotel for a little more than 24 hours, and... did some editing.
It's very fun.
Oh, well, and I had wine.
I was asking more about how your progress was, but good. I'm glad you had wine too.
I did. They gave it to me for free. I mean, what do you do?
Nice.
No. Actually, it was good. It was good to just like be gone all day and like. Ponder.
That be your agenda.
Yeah, ponder pieces of stuff that needed to go together. And it was funny because Leslie, my friend Leslie, she had to go to this lawyer event that was like some private practice, I think, and some state lawyers that deal with like taxes and other things like that, I think. I don't know because I didn't go to the event with her. But anyway, she had to go to this event and meet these lawyers and like, you know, do that stuff because that's her job. And she said,
so
hey,
she had to work is what you're trying to say.
But she said, do you want to come with me and hang out and write all weekend while I'm doing this? Cause they pay for the hotel room. So I was like, sure. I'll come along. So like I spent all day in that room and wrote. It was a nice room, so it wasn't a big, you know, it wasn't a problem. It wasn't torture to be there or anything. And then they fed me dinner that night because, you know, they were having a dinner anyways. So I went to the dinner and the lawyers were all like, oh, so did you like go out and, you know, walk around the vineyards or did you go wine tasting or blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I was in this room all day working on my novel. And they all got real quiet. And no. Kind of looked at me and they're like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then they're like, you know, so who's your publisher? And I'm like, well, as a matter of fact, it's Harrelson Press and it's a small press. And
yay!
They're like, oh. And then, like, they just kind of kept drilling down on it. They're like, so what kind of book is this? So... you didn't really do anything else. I was like, no, I literally sat in that room all day long. And if you look at my health stats on my iPhone, you will see that I did not walk around. I have no steps that day. I was like in that room all day. But yeah, it was good. Good to just get into a different physical space, to be in a different headspace, to be writing. And so I can understand why you'd be jealous because that's, is a good thing. It's something that I think a lot of us say, oh, we should do that, but then we don't do it. And so when I had the chance, I did, and it was worth it. And if I could just put a plug out there for a Thinking Out Loud writing retreat, that's what I'm talking about, folks. I'm talking about a couple of bottles of wine and us and our computers in a new environment and some time to just focus on whatever it is we're working on. So, get yourselves ready, because that's what we're going to do.
That is what we're going to do, and we're going to do it this fall. I have one more thing that I'm working on with somebody that I have to check dates on.
Okay.
And then we can really hit the ground running with
the dates on that.
Yes. So exciting. Actually, I was planning on talking to you about that, about planning this.
Yeah.
Getting the ball rolling for real. So I have done some preliminary research on places that we could stay. So I think it's looking pretty good.
Nice.
Woohoo.
Yay. So then all we need is people to come write with us.
All we need is people. Come on.
Come write with us. We will provide the
community. Yeah, and I think that does make such a big difference. I mean, I got a chance where I was waiting on emails just last week and I got a chance to write for 45 minutes, which sounds... like, not very much, you know? But I got so much work done in that period of time because so much of my work right now is writing for other people. Mm-hmm. And I got to the halfway mark. So my manuscript is now at 40,000 words.
Nice. Yes. See, when you get a little chunk of time, don't waste it.
It makes a big difference, doesn't it? And I've also been adding, I told you I've taken, well, we had this conversation, what was it, two or three shows ago where we talked about the difficult things that you don't want to talk about. And once you get over the fact that you're going to have to talk about them and then you can actually write them, then you can actually get somewhere.
Yes.
But if you keep ignoring the fact that you have to write about the things that you don't want to write about and try to write about other things that you do want to write about instead of the things that you don't want to write about, then you get stuck.
Well, and so that's what Gabriella, DIY MFA, that's what she attributes writer's block to. She says writer's block is kind of just like a myth, and that it's not actually writer's block, that what it is you being resistant to the thing that you're supposed to be writing. So, like, when you hit resistance, you think, no, I don't have anything to say, or I can't think of anything to say, but that's not true. Like, you just are resistant to the thing that you need to say.
Yeah. And you're not writing the story that you need to write. You're writing the story that you want to write, which will come across as inauthentic to your readers. Fake. Okay. So, I have a couple of things. So, I've been reading this. Do you know Madeline Lingle?
A Wrinkle in Time, lady. I wrote her a note. It would be like 10 years ago now. I wrote a letter to Madeline Lingle to tell her thank you for writing her books because they were so inspirational to me when I was a kid. And her sister or her daughter or somebody wrote me back, but not her because she was not well at the time. And is she...
I don't know. Now that I should have definitely looked that up before bringing her up. Look it up real quick. Okay, so I've been reading her book, Walking on Water, okay, which is Reflections on Faith and Art.
Uh-huh.
Which you would love. You would love.
I think I saw you...
you need to read this book.
...post about that on Goodreads. And it looks like she has not... She has not passed, but she was born in 1918, so she is quite... elderly.
Yeah, I know. Like, okay, so I've marked like three things that I want to read about this from this book.
Do
okay?
it. Let's Inspire see. Us with Madeline Lingle's word.
Okay, let's see which one am I going to first.
Oh, we have dead air here. Let me just fill the dead air while you.
I'm sorry.
So
she is still alive. This is funny that you wrote a note to her, though. Okay. Okay, okay. Here we go.
I got a response from family. Better response. So, cool.
Hey, you know who I just did that to? I just did it to Sandra Boyden, who is the board book. And I wrote her on her Facebook page because I was reading the book to Ben that my second grader who could not read. It was the first book he read independently.
Nice.
At the end of his second grade year. Like, second semester, second grade, the first book he read independently by himself. And I was reading it to Ben, and I was thinking, oh, this was in my classroom when this kid read it. Like, this is the book, like, you know, the copy of the book that he read. And so I was like, I just need to write. And I don't usually do that, so that was pretty...
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, honestly, people should do that more, reach out to the people that inspired you, whether they're authors or singers or artists or the neighbor down the street or whatever. Write them out.
We should thank people more often than we do for the inspiration and guidance they give us.
I agree.
That's true. Okay, so maybe I'm going to have to write Madeline Lingle a note now after this book. Okay, so here's what she says. So there's a lot about faith in here, but there's all these tidbits about writing, too, that I just couldn't ignore. Okay, so for most writers, it takes many manuscripts before enough royalties are coming in to pay for a roof over the head and bread on the table. Other jobs must often be found to take care of bread and butter. A certain amount of stubbornness, pig-headedness, is essential.
Yes.
I like that one. And that goes along with what we're trying to do as we create, you know? I was thinking, okay, well, what if the people who are listening to this are like, well, I've got a real job. I can't just take off and go to a conference with my friend because she has a hotel room and write. Well, that's because you have worked really hard to create something that allows you the flexibility of schedule to do those kinds of things. Exactly. You've created a way of life and you've created a business. And this is why you have the opportunity to go do those things. And so this is what she says about work. In this last stretch of the 20th century, we're losing the ability to equate work with play. And there are many self-evident reasons for this. One publishing house owned by a conglomerate was told it must drop from its list any book which did not sell a mandatory number of copies during a year. And so the works of a poet such as Yeats have been discarded, are no longer available, are out of print. Greed is not the only reason for this. Too many books are published which are shabbily and shoddily written. Many are simply rough drafts, and most first drafts need long and hard revision. And that means work, and we have been taught to look down on work. But one reason for this is that much work is not, in fact, work, but drudgery. So, if you didn't believe us that your book needs revision, you have to believe Madeline Lingle. Because she is a very renowned author.
Why would you lie, exactly?
Okay, and here's the other one. To write consistently, I must seize opportunities, just like you just did. I write in airports, I write on planes, I find airports and planes and hotel rooms excellent places in which to write because while I am in them, I am not responsible for anything except my work. And that's what you just did. Meanwhile, I read about doing that.
Well, there's like steps to everything, right? There's steps to everything. I was trying to find what was the title of that book again?
Walking on Water. I would offer to send you this, but I really can't let it go. Totally fine. I'm sorry.
I get it with like stuff like that. It's not.
Or I might just need a couple more months to work through all of the underlines and marginalia I have on here. And then I'll send it to you. But there's so many marks, though.
I mean, it's one of those that you might just need to keep. You could buy me a new copy.
You might need your own copy.
Merry Christmas or happy half birthday in a month or something like that.
or something.
But, yeah, because, like, you know, there are certain books that I'm never letting out of my sight either. And, you know, some of them are fiction that I just appreciate or whatever, but then there are also definitely nonfiction books that I'm like, no, this one is mine. I keep this one.
Okay, so here's the last quote. When we are writing or painting or composing, we are during the time of creativity freed from normal restrictions and are open to a wider world where colors are brighter, sounds clearer, and people more wondrously complex than we normally realize. Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
So that's why we do all the drudgery of the revision, as she said. But I think, you know, for me, sometimes it feels like even when I'm talking to you, although you are a professional in the industry too, it feels like, well, am I right about this? You know, are there lots of books that are published that are really first drafts? Like, maybe it's just me and Elizabeth. You know, at least it's not just me that I feel like. I'm like, well, she thinks so too. So obviously there must be some credence to what I'm saying. But then people give you a hard time. They're like, no, such and such has read over it and it's good. And I'm like, I'm not saying it's not good. I'm saying it needs work. Right. Those are two different things. And then sometimes I get notification from people for manuscripts I've rejected, and they've said, well, this other publisher is going to publish it. And I'm like, yeah,
exactly.
Great.
Say congratulations and move on.
But, you know, it does make you feel like perhaps I've, you know, I haven't been in this business very long. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Well, no, especially because, like,
but Madeline Lingle says it, so now I have it. I'm going to hold this book to my heart.
And you need to
use it as my shield.
If your first instinct is to reject something, you can't, I mean, you have to go with that. You have to allow yourself to to say no to things and not feel guilty, even if somebody else says yes to it. Because, like, for whatever reason that other person is saying yes, like, that's their, that's, like, their deal. It has nothing to do with you. You say no based on what you know.
Well, and this,
that's all you can do.
And I'll be honest, most of the time that I see a manuscript, like, I can see potential in it. So I very rarely have said no. I have most often said, here's my recommendation. Do some freelance editing and then let's talk. Because there is good potential in here, but it needs some work. Like, that's more often my response than just a straight out, no, there's no potential in this. Anyways, it made me feel better to hear Madeline Lingle say that there are a lot of books, first drafts, she says. She doesn't even call them books. Isn't that interesting? She doesn't even call them manuscripts. She calls them first drafts because a manuscript is something that's ready to send to a publisher, is what I'm inferring that she's kind of hinting at here.
It's true.
And so when you say, I have a manuscript, no, you have a rough draft, or you have a first draft, or you have a second draft. And then when you go through that drafting process and that revision process, then you have a manuscript that you're ready to send to somebody.
Well, and so the thing is that, you know, like, in this day and age, a person can publish anything at any point in the process of having a book. So if they want to publish something that you don't think is ready, they can go publish that. And there's nobody to tell them otherwise. You know, like, there could be, you know, somebody else who says, sure, I'll help you publish that. And that's great. Like, that's somebody who helps them do that. But that doesn't mean that your standards are wrong. It means that you have a set of standards that you're going by. There's no reason that you should have to change those just based on the fact that somebody has an itchy trigger finger for hitting publish. So just my two cents.
And not just yours, yes. Madeline Lingle's too. Just saying.
Good old Madeline Lingle. We should get a picture of her and, like, put it up so we can, you know, evoke her spirit when we need to.
Oh, let's do that in the show notes. Do you know what show number
this is? It's 110. I thought we were on 101.
110. Can you believe it?
We just keep on
us calling. Out. Oh, but do we have any pick?
Do we what?
Oh, okay. This is a good one. Well, I was trying. There are all these ones that have a quote with it.
Post it. Yeah, put it in the show notes for you people because, you know, it's going to be necessary. And hopefully it will inspire you to continue working. Because that's the thing, too, is that just, you know, like, sometimes you have to resist that itchy trigger finger. You know, you have to say, no, let me go through this process one more time and see what else I can, you know, get out of this manuscript before I publish. And sometimes you need to, sometimes you need to just publish because sometimes, you know, when is a manuscript ever really at the end of its revision? It's not always, like, ready. I mean, it's never ready, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So, like, sometimes you have to just press the button, but other times, like, when you get feedback that maybe it's counter to your high opinion of what you've written, you should take that to heart and keep working.
Yeah. And so a manuscript is always a work in progress. That's something that it's not going to be finished, but there is a sense that as a publisher on the other side, I do expect to do a certain amount of editing part of the acceptance process. And so I expect to do a copy edit. I expect to do some minor revisions, but I'm talking about when I experience a draft and not a manuscript. You know, somebody will tell me, this has happened a couple of times. Oh, I've just finished my book. I can't wait. Let me send it to you. And I'm thinking, okay, did you just finish writing it? Because if you just finished writing it, it's really not time to send it to me. Most of the time, these are people who I know. And so I understand what they're, you know, I understand that perhaps they wouldn't, it doesn't feel as formal of a process because they know who I am. And they also know that we're a small publishing house. I get that aspect of it. But part of me wants to ask, okay, what do you mean you just finished your book? Because let me guarantee you something. If you just finished your book, you gotta have somebody else's eyes on it. And you don't want those eyes to be me if you're asking me as a publisher. Like, what are we talking about? Are you asking me as a friend? Or are you asking me as a publisher? Because those are two separate things. And if it's as a friend, like, I can't do that because this is my job. And if it's as a publisher, like, you're not, that's not going to be a very good impression. But I get this all the dang time. Like, yes, I just finished my book. I can't wait to send it to you.
Like, you're like, maybe you should wait a little.
Really?
Just a little.
Yeah. Like, have you read over it even? And in a lot of cases, no, they haven't even read over it. The ones I do like to get are, I just read a book and I've had a couple of people read it who said it was very good. And then I had an editor who I worked with. And I'm like, yes, send me that one. I want that one. That is a manuscript.
You're like, thank you very much.
But that doesn't often happen.
No, because people get impatient.
Yes. Okay, so that's a great point. Expand on what you mean by that. And it goes back to your point of anything... You're able to publish anything quickly.
I think, you know, you want it to be a book because that's what you see, you know, already. You see the book that is being written and you see the end, but like you're not all the way there yet. And so sometimes you've been in the process of writing it for so long that you're like, ugh, I just want to be done with this. But if it's not ready, it's not ready. So you have to keep writing to the end. I have a client that I've had since I very first started writing Refinery, and she's working on her third novel right now. And she texted me today and was like, oh my gosh, I cannot finish this book and it will not be done. And oh my gosh, I need to finish it and help me. I don't know what to do. And I'm like, you can do this, but you have to finish. And she's like, I don't know how to end it. I'm like, okay. But I think you do, and let's work on it, and let's get through it, and don't scrap it, don't run away, don't try to publish it before it's ready, you know. And she's like, I'm just afraid it's not going to be good, and I'm like, please, write it, and we can edit it. I was like, we can edit anything, it'll be fine, but you have to write it first. So, like, there's... you know, an eagerness to be finished and to be able to be released and move on to the next thing. But you have to do justice to the idea that you have to begin with, I think.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that Madeline Lingle in her book talks about, too. Like, you have to write the story. Okay, so we talked about at the beginning, you have to write the story not only that you want to write, but the story that has to be written. And I know that's a switch to the passive and it sounds kind of magical and mystical, but I think it's true. There are some aspects of it that once you get into the process of writing a book that you'll realize, oh my gosh, this is not the book that I thought I was going to write. At least that's been my experience thus far. Madeline Lingle says it's her experience too. What about you? Let's add a third one and then solidify the whole thing because three people say it's so.
I think that probably happens to me, but every time because I'm a pantser. So like I sit down with an idea and I just watch it grow, right?
Yeah. So you just expect this is going to happen. So it's not as shocking as to the outliners and the planners out there.
Not at all. So, but I think that still confirms your position there, so.
I do appreciate that. I do like being right. Sure. I like even more finding people who agree with me. and bringing those to the table to show other people that I'm right.
People that
that's like my second favorite thing.
Sometimes we need people that disagree with us too, though. So it's good. It's good.
Indeed, but I think for this, the fact that you shouldn't send your first draft.
Yeah, I think that's a fact
that is universally. We wouldn't find many people who would say, no, it'll work out for you. Go ahead, try it.
That's why I started freelance editing. Because the slush pile had too many first drafts in it. And I was like, dude, you're going to be rejected right now because you did not show this to an editor first.
Just think. Okay, so in that slush pile, how many... Okay, just ballpark. What percentage would you say are those? And what percentage would you say are quality manuscripts that are just going to get overlooked?
That are quality manuscripts that are overlooked is less than 1%.
But that was an... Oh, okay, so I see what you're saying. So you're saying... See, and in my experience, it's kind of different in that I saw the potential in work and I thought, I can set up a publishing house where these stories are getting more attention instead of getting no response at all. Which is kind of the same thing, you know, but I guess I was dealing with more of the... Well, I was at that time dealing with more of the 1%. Now, I understand completely.
You see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. I see what a lot of publishers are saying, too. Like, you just get so many manuscripts that are first drafts that you either... And this is, I mean, this is one of the things that had started happening to me is that I was just getting partial manuscripts with people saying, I expect to be finished with this in 6 weeks. And I'm going, you're only halfway there. Like, I just don't think that's going to happen. And so I had to, and that's why I think a lot of publishers put up stipulations
submissions, and they only take,
Or a certain genre, or, you know, and it has to do with your experience and discovering, I know a couple of publishers who don't accept novellas because they're not novellas. They're just unfinished manuscripts.
You're like, so you...
Like, no, that's a real genre.
Early, didn't you?
Yeah, this is... That's a real genre, not an excuse not to finish your manuscript. It's a tough gig.
It is, but there and are I plenty like, of good stories out there. They just need work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert?
No.
She talks about on... Wait, I wasn't finished. That was a pause, not an end stop. You and Sam, you guys both do this to me. Okay, wait a second. Let me think about how to phrase this sentence again so you don't insert commentary in the middle. So Elizabeth Gilbert in Magic Lessons tells us...
There you go.
I got my verb in before. She says that stories are floating around above our heads.
Yeah,
did we talk about this last time?
The magic thing where she talks about the stories that come to you and then they go away if you don't.
If you don't write them, and you don't always have to write them. But guess what? In this book, Walking on Water, Madeline Lingle says the same thing. I don't know. That's two people. Find one more, and then it's true.
It's kind of true. And especially from the standpoint of, like, you know, you don't have to take every idea that comes to you either. Like, some are the ones that are meant for you, and some of them are not. And it's really okay to be able to let go of some ideas and let someone else take over.
And I think that's a freedom and a freeing experience. To say, oh, I'm going to let that one float on to somebody who's more prepared to write that one. And, you know, Madeline Lingle talks about how she, in her personal journals, she writes a lot of these kind of story starters or just ideas for stories. And she goes, and they'll never be anything except that my family sees in my journals after I pass away. But, I needed to write because I needed to write that scenario because I needed to write. And I needed to remind myself that these stories are all around us if we just open our eyes and open our ears and open our hearts to be receptive of that. And I thought, oh, you know, for me, I often just let ideas or scenes or turns of phrases or anything, like, I just let it float on. But capturing it into a journal does get you in the habit of writing it.
Definitely. Well,
and capturing it in some way. Or attempting to capture it, which I think is a good practice too for a writer.
So for me, and this, I guess, is where, you know, that whole, this wasn't the story I thought I was going to write thing kind of comes out for me, is like when I'm doing nano and I have like a new idea or whatever, I write scenes and scenes and scenes, and they're not always in chronological order and connected. And they don't all always end up in the final draft either, because they're just, they're seeds of ideas that I'm like, oh, well, what if this? And oh, well, what if this? And oh, maybe this. And then like, I kind of chip off the ones that don't fit the story at the time and let the real idea take hold at the end.
I like that. I'm thinking about it a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I think that's important. Okay, so now I think this is an appropriate time to ask you the question about the naked guy.
Yeah, I told you to remind me to tell you that story. Okay, so...
Right? So I feel like this is a good character that perhaps could enter into a story. Could
it's
be
always
a good
possible. He will not story belong starter. In the story that I am currently writing. But it's possible that he'll go in somewhere else. So I live in an apartment complex here in California, and it's a decent complex. There's some you know, a mix of people, mostly students that live here because it's a college town. So, you know, lots of students living in apartments and stuff. And there's a family. It's I don't know if it's husband and wife or boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, whatever, that live in one of the units near me. It's like a building that's adjacent to mine. And they have a little child, that is super cute, super cute baby that
a mini human
that they go around with, and they are always singing funny little songs too, or whatever. And she is just beautiful, like the mother, super pretty woman, super nice. We don't really interact all that much, but you know, whatever. And he is really tall and has this bushy hair and is very much the hipster, hippie human being. Like, he's not bad to look at, but you know, like, he's definitely a hipster. And so like, I see them around the apartment complex all the time. They walk a dog, you know, they have the baby, blah, blah, blah. And so one night I'm coming back with Noah from walking our dog for his last call, because he always gets last call before bedtime. He has to go potty before we go to bed. And so it's dark out, and we came around the corner into the parking lot in our complex. It's, so I have to reiterate, it's dark, like, you know, all the things that go with dark. A, you can't see the people that are outside. B, if the lights are on, you can see everything that's inside. And I like look over towards the building, and there is Mr. Tall Hippie Man standing in the window of his kitchen, getting something out of his refrigerator and completely naked, completely naked, like the full Monty. I'm like, oh my God, there's a naked man standing in that window. And
There's a naked man, and not only a naked man, yeah, but my naked neighbor.
So, like, he's on the bottom floor too. So it's not like, you know, I had to look up to see him or anything. He's like right there. And I'm like, he can't see me, but I can see every tiny little bit of him. Yeah.
All of him.
And so, like, I was like, oh my God. And Noah was like throwing dog poop in the dumpster or whatever. He didn't see it. And by the time he turned around, he was gone. I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I just saw the hippie man naked. And so now, though, like, I see him a lot still. Like, when I go walking around and, like, I walked past him in the alley the other day with my dog. And he's like, hey. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't even talk to you because I've seen you naked. I'm like, I don't even know your name.
Was it an unpleasant experience? Looking,
but I'm like, I don't even know his name. Like, how do I ask his name now? I've seen him naked. Like, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, and you don't really bring that up in conversation. Hey, I saw you in your kitchen naked.
Like, I'm
Elizabeth, by the way.
You know, like, after that, and they're like, your dog is so good looking. And I'm like, yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
You know, everybody needs a good naked neighbor.
Well, that one is
mine.
He's definitely not ugly naked guy like in Friends or anything, but it's just one of those things where every time I see him, I'm like, uh-huh. Yep. Saw you naked.
In Gilmore Girls, also, there is a naked guy.
I'm trying to remember.
So,
and
Marty, when she goes to college. Oh my gosh. Elizabeth, do you understand that more Gilmore Girls are coming?
I remember
you have
now.
To... Okay.
I remember now. I was just thinking of Kurt. I feel like he was naked at some point too.
Oh, yes, he does. He has night terrors and gets naked. That's true. Okay, so there are two naked guys in Gilmore Girls. You know what? If you're stuck on your manuscript. Yeah, I know, right? If you're stuck on your manuscript, just insert a naked guy.
Nobody will think any different.
Spice things up a bit.
Awesome.
Oh. Okay, that is a good naked guy story.
It's ongoing because I still see him whenever I go anywhere, so.
You see him, but you don't see all of him, right?
Covered, so.
Oh. Okay, yeah, that was definitely worth it. I thought it was going to be somebody out in the public, public, that like a passerby, but no, this is someone that you keep having interactions with, so this is good.
Yep.
This is good.
And one day he will move away, and I'll be like, remember when that naked guy lived in our building? But it's another reason why I'm like, this is why I close the shades, people. I close the shades so that I don't have to cause you embarrassment because you saw me naked.
There comes a time when it's the time of the night where you close the shades.
Exactly.
Well, we do have one more thing we wanted to talk about,
don't
we? Are
we bringing on our special guest? Yay!
We are.
Special
the non-naked guy.
But there was this one time at Asbury Hills.
No, there wasn't. Don't even spread a lie like that. There was never a time.
There was a fire pit and guitar playing.
There was a fire pit and guitar playing.
And the sacred turtle.
I don't know if I know the sacred turtle. I do.
You don't remember the turtle story that
we always
read?
I remember the turtle story because I remember that was during a phase when I was way too rigid with my spiritual beliefs. And so I didn't like the fact that they called that God was a she in there. It bothered me.
Oh, I know.
And now I don't believe in God, so it doesn't,
doesn't
really matter. But, you know.
The
tables,
have turned.
How my mind has broadened.
Yeah, no, that's hilarious.
It's unhinged.
So hi.
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 Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
To talk with us about.
If you don't recognize this sexy voice, it's Sam Harrelson.
Speaking of naked men, right?
From Thinking Religion.
I'm wearing clothes.
Our happy hour shows have a kind of different flair.
I can tell. I can tell. I thought this was like the you know, like the Playboy TV channel on Sirius XM or something.
No.
That's okay. I mean, well, they get good ratings. That's okay. But there is a connection to what we're going to talk about.
Wait, it would be play that. Girl, right? Because we're two female hosts.
No, but it's men listening on Sirius XM, and they want to hear women talking about things. Yeah, you don't want to hear two guys.
They want women talking about naked guys?
Heterosexual men want women talking about...
naked girls.
Yes, right.
So our naked guy story is not going to get us a nomination.
Well, I mean, not with the heterosexual guys or that listen to Sirius XM. Or but...
rabid puppies, which is the segue that exactly. we're trying to make here.
Which is why, yeah, I was trying to transfer to that slowly, nope. But Mariana wasn't buying it. Do you know any of this, by the way, Mariana? And Elizabeth, yes, so you're
that's
aware,
why
right?
I was You've suggesting that followed. We talk about today, the Hugo Awards, and this whole thing, it's kind of all like wrapped up in Gamergate and then the science fiction fantasy community. It's just kind of like a spillover of the same sexism, crazy racism, whatever else is going on out there. And then this happened this year, which
yeah,
it just keeps getting crazier. But yeah, so that's why you're here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not the expert by any means, but you know, basically, starting in 2014, really in 2015 was kind of the last year was considered the year the puppy,
right. Sad puppies,
the sad
and then puppies,
rabid puppies. I think it's their. Right, right. So they sort of hijacked the Hugo Awards. And the Hugo Awards are in this weird world of science fiction writing, the Hugo Awards are sort of like the Oscars, and the Nebula Awards are just below that. So they're kind of like the Golden Globes, I guess. And to win a Hugo, or to vote in the Hugo Awards, you have to sign up to attend the conference, their annual yearly conference,
Worldcon.
I forgot the name of the whole.
I think that's just it.
Worldcon, yeah, and I think it costs like $40 or $45 to sign up, and once you do that, you're able to vote in the Hugo Awards, which, for any other genre, I mean that sounds insane to be, you know, to be able to say, well, here's $45, and you know, now I can vote on these awards, but they've never had a large number of votes. So I think maybe George R.R. Martin talked about this in his blog post last year about the sad puppies, and he said that there was something like 1,800 votes in 2013 for the best novel award, which is by far the the right. most popular thing to vote on. So yeah, I mean, 1,800 votes for something like that, you know, that you get the Hugo stamp and all of a sudden you're John Scalzi,
right,
and you're the man, right?
Yeah.
Or the woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But going back, I mean, Asimov, Heinlein, yeah, you know, it, Ursula Le Guin, like everyone who's someone in science fiction has won a Hugo Award. So it does have kind of that cachet to it. Yeah, so around the same time that we saw the rise of Gamergate, sort of in the gaming community, and these attacks, if you will, by people, predominantly white male, cisgender, heterosexual guys, with little else to do and an extra grind, they were upset by the sort of the takeover of game development by female.
Like, it's not an
yeah exactly
takeover
right, right
here
and
perception.
No, definitely.
You can't see his fingers. He was doing air quotes.
Right.
He was forgetting that this was audio and not visual.
No, I don't do visual. Right. So that perceived takeover, that assault on what made sci-fi great, or in this case, what made gaming great. Like, let's just go back to, you know, that kind of stuff. And then that's sort of spilled over online into a number of categories. And one of those is science fiction writing. So you've got these groups of the rabid puppies and the sad puppies, and there's a couple of 4chan groups that are out there as well, and it's almost mm-hmm. like this crusade, in the true sense of that word, to go after the social justice warriors, as they're called, the SJWs, and to, you know, reclaim science fiction or gaming or Band-Aid making or whatever your cause is, to reclaim that from the transgender and the African-American or the marginalized voice or the feminists or, women, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Not so, women, feminist. They're different.
And it's easy for us to say, okay, this is really stupid. And, you know, it, like, put a spaceship on the cover. And if the book sells, then it sells. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't sell. And, you know, I'm completely against this. But their argument is something along the lines of, well, science fiction used to be upbeat and forward-looking and thinking about the future. But now it's all sort of politically correct and it's mired in politics and it's so inward looking that we don't have that forward vision anymore. And we saw this with something as pedestrian as Chuck Wendig's novel, right? With Aftermath, which is a great book and it was a lot of fun and I loved it. Mm-hmm. I think I read that in like 2 days and, you know, it's just such a good read, but lo and behold, you know, it wasn't a strong male character there. And there were some, you know, homosexual situations and that
set off that kind of diversity in his character representation.
Right. Right. Star Wars. Yeah. Star Wars should be white males. And that's how I grew up. And that's what I expect. Right. Exactly. Damsels in distress, which is why, you know, that same crowd hates things like The Force Awakens. You know, when Mariana just saw it for the first time. You talked about this.
I didn't really see it.
I know. It wasn't my fault.
I haven't really seen it.
She was being hyperbolic. I wasn't trying to mansplain it to her too much. But, you know, the point.
Actually, our 8-year-old was the one that was worse.
8-year-old girl.
Yeah. Now, you have to pay attention to this one because she is really important and she's really awesome and she's my, okay, stop.
And look how she tells Finn not to grab her hand and look how she tells Finn not to ask her if she's okay because he was the one that passed out. So anyway, all that to say, in 2014, there was a lot of pushback from that very small minority, but very loud minority, just like with Gamergate, just like with the political world we're seeing right now with the rise of Donald Trump, etc. But it's all connected, right? It's that sort of strand of populism based on negativity, but they perceive it as making something great again because it used to be really good before all the gays and the blacks and the women got involved and messed it up.
Well, everybody had to hide from being themselves. Yes, it was great for you.
Well, it's hard to be a young white male.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So in 2014, one white male that was on the best novel list for the Hugos, and that really spurred some blowback. So in 2015, last year, there was a very concerted effort by these groups to kind of sway the ballot, and the same thing happened this year.
What they did was they had a slate,
and they
were like campaigning for people who were their supporters to vote only for the people that they had pre-approved to get onto the slate and then to get nominated and then win the awards. But.
Yeah, so it was the Vox Day.
Yep.
Yeah, Vox Day. I'll put a list of So I'll put a list of 2016 nominees in the show notes as well. Best novel, they actually did not get to really infiltrate too much. I mean, there's some blowback about the Jim Butcher book, but I mean, I don't think that's too bad. It's, you know, it's pedestrian sci-fi, but it's nothing too terrible. But Leckie's book, Ancillary Mercy, I haven't read that one yet. I've read Ancillary Justice and Ancillary Sword, and those are fantastic. And she's doing some things with science fiction that... you know, we haven't seen in a long, long time, especially from that perspective of kind of the female consciousness. And there's in the book, there's only female pronouns. So it really, you know, plays with kind of common conventions of science fiction. And it's a fantastic book and highly suggest Ancillary Justice to start off with. But I'm glad to see her book is up this year. And of course, Neal Stephenson's on there for Seven Eves, which is wonderful book. I mean, it's
the one that was on the great read. Slate, because that was, I think, the other thing that people were irritated about is that like they were choosing some like ringers to put on their slate so that then they can be like, look, you know, Neal Stephenson won the award because we voted for him. It was, anyways.
Yep, yep, exactly. Right, right. And George R. R. Martin talks about that. And, you know, he talks about how this is really nothing new because in 1987 or 1978, one of the two, the Scientologist did kind of a similar campaign for L. Ron Hubbard. No, it's 1978, I believe, for L. Ron Hubbard's book. I forgot the name of it. Black something. And... no, see, that's what causes all the noises.
But that's because we're trying to figure out what book you were talking about.
Yeah, I can't remember. I'll figure it out. But the Scientologists did the same thing in I believe it was the 70s, where they wrote in and did their, that's kind of make noise, because they're Scientologists. Look up L. Ron Hubbard books. And basically they gave the award, they didn't give the award, but the science fiction community got together and said, well, we really don't want L. Ron Hubbard to win this. So they all voted for a Orson Scott Card book. And not that Orson Scott Card is much, you know, as a person much better, but it was an interesting dynamic there. And George R. R. Martin talks about how throughout the 80s that also occurred, where you would write to your friend and say, hey, I'll nominate you if you nominate me, and let's get a little voting block together.
It's like middle school government.
But, there's all kinds of author groups and author clubs that do the same thing.
Yeah.
Not for political reasons, but...
But we've talked about this with Amazon reviews, too.
Exactly.
About, hey, my book's coming out for... on Amazon, why don't you go and you write me a review, and then I'll write you a review once your book comes out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the big difference and the big shame here is that it has to do with really expanding what science fiction is as a genre and taking it away from, finally, from that, you know, white male heteronormative idea of, you know, hey, let's go play Star Wars and have space operas where the white guys are on spaceships. And the Klingons are kind of brown, black, and, you know, the bad guys in space are brown and black. And the women are, scantily clad, or the damsels in distress, and they need the strong white males to come in and rescue them. You know, because science fiction is always a projection of society. And, you know, these, you know, sad puppies or whatever, idiots, like, they want to make science fiction into something that it's not. You know, it was never predictive. It's always...
Right.
Sort of introspective. And we've had apocalypse science fiction for a long time. It's not that it's depressing. It's that we're wrestling with some heavy shit right now, you know, in society and culture. And that's okay. And science fiction helps us do that. To go back to the biblical times, you know, we have apocalypse literature like the Gospel of Enoch and these sort of notions of trying to figure out what's going on here on Earth by looking at what's going on in some other dimension or some other, you know, level of the cosmos or whatever. And, you know, to take that away and say, no, let's make it fun again and put spaceships on the cover and make it about things that don't have to do with sexuality and politics. Like, it's...
But it did have to do with sexuality and politics. That's the thing. It's just not sexuality and politics that you agree with or that... aligns with your viewpoint and perspective.
In that the voices and the people who are writing now are writing about people like them instead of writing about people that are like the sad puppies.
Right.
But it's exactly what we were talking about before. Like, we all like to be right, and so we find our little group of people who agree with us and forget to challenge ourselves to think outside of who we are and who we usually talk to.
So the interesting thing this year as well is that the puppies have put up Chuck Tingle in a number of categories. And Chuck Tingle writes these bizarre niche erotica novels that are evidently really popular on things like Kindle.
Well, I mean, the romance and erotica genres have exploded since... the advent of e-readers, because you don't even have to walk out of the store and hide the cover anymore. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. It's
the best-selling genre on e-readers.
That's why I never mind. And his masterwork is known as Pounded in the Butt by My Own Butt, which I kind of want to read now because I want to know what's going on there.
Do you?
It's this.
Pounded in the Butt.
Anyways, moving on here. I mean, the point being, they put him.
So they put him up.
Speaking of naked guys.
They were like,
well, I'm just saying, so he's
making a joke, basically. They were like, this is what these awards are now.
Yeah, right. And he's actually trolling them back and saying, yeah, yeah. What is it? For every vote, he's giving money to Zoe Quinn.
He has her slated to accept the award on his behalf. Yeah.
Oh, you're right. You're right. That's what it is. Yeah, yeah. So, and Zoe Quinn, if you don't, I mean, if
people don't know him, go ahead.
You don't follow. Yeah, so Zoe Quinn became prominent during the stop hitting the keyboard.
Oh, domestic.
This is the dangers of recording that in room. Zoe Quinn came to prominence during the Gamergate fiasco early last year. And she sort of was one of the targets with Brianna Wu and a couple of other female identified developers and gamers. So anyway, he's kind of trolling this group by saying, okay, fine, you know, if you want to vote for me and if you give me this award, yeah, I'm going to let Zoe go up and accept the award. Because I know Brianna is a transgender person, but I'm not sure if Zoe, how she identifies that way. But, you know, I know she got a lot of flack from the Gamergate community. So that's a fantastic way to do it. And I kind of want to go buy all of his books now and support him because of that.
Thank you for not, like, feeding into the rest of it.
I mean,
not that he would. I think that's the thing that Sad Puppies was, they weren't thinking it through when they did that. Because if you're going to write, like, erotica, like, you're not going to, you don't think like the masses, you know? Like, you kind of think on the fringes anyways. And you have a fringe audience that you identify with. And so, like, that was their first mistake, was forgetting that, like, that was the whole point. But.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we often see this when it comes to movements involving angry young men, you know, whether it's ISIS or Anonymous or 4chan or, you know, whatever. It's Hitler Youth, right? You know, it's this idea of we're going to, you know, recapture this and make it great again. And not really putting the thought behind it and not really thinking about the ramifications of, okay, right, if I pull this string, what happens to that string?
Too bad for them. I hope it, you know, and if that's where it goes this year, that's how it works.
Well, it goes back to that idea that you two talk about all the time. It's if we're going to hold up being an author and giving awards to other authors as a meritocracy and saying, okay, well, you know, Chuck Wendig really deserves this award, or Ursula Le Guin really deserves this, or Madeleine L'Engle really deserves this, whoever. Right. How do we justify that? Is it by popular vote? Is it by, you know, gosh darn it, we just think your stuff is so good, and we got a group of past Academy Award winners or past Grammy Award winners or whatever. Like, you know, how do we give out these awards and why? And
it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. We need to do a better job of those who are inspired and challenged by these artists' work of saying that to people and of being part of the group that
so,
you know,
that.
The audience and saying, hey, I'm out here and I appreciate what you're saying, instead of, you know, making authors kind of depend on the New York Times bestsellers list or whatever else.
Like, establishment to say it for you. Just go ahead and say it.
And this is what I hear over and over again from authors that are published. It doesn't matter what awards they win. It matters those individual notes that they get. Like your note that you sent Madeleine L'Engle.
I hope
that was, I'm sure, read aloud
to
her.
I like to think it was.
And, and she... And she drafted the response and just sent it via a family member.
No, I'm...
I'm sure that's how it happened.
Yeah. But, it, you know, it's... Yeah, I just think that's such a fascinating conversation. Because, you know, 10, 20, 30, 150 years, well, you know, however long before we had something like the web, if you had a good song in your head, or if you had a good story in your head, or if you had a good podcast in your head, if you weren't signed to a deal for distribution, you could write that story, and maybe, you know, the 50 people in your neighborhood in Brooklyn would read your story in their zine, but that was not ever going to get onto the plates of, you know, potentially millions of people. And now we have that opportunity, whether it's, you know, having something like an amazing story or an amazing vision and putting it out there and saying, I'm going to shape the world around this vision or around this story because mm-hmm. I know it's worth something. And it feels like we went through, you know, the last 10, 15 years of having that possibility. But now that seems to be closing back up again, whether it's because of the populism of Trump or the idiocracy of this whole social justice warrior Gamergate bullshit or BS, I'm sorry, or whether it's, you know, the takeover of the web by Google, Facebook, Amazon,
or Apple. Whether it's just because really crappy stuff got published and people didn't actually take the time to put quality stuff out there. That's what we're just talking about.
I mean, you know, sometimes I like listening to B-sides of bands that I enjoy.
Because you know it's the B-side.
Well, but like Radiohead has been working on this one song for 24 years. And it just came out on their new album today, but they've been tinkering with it and playing with it because they had that privilege and that luxury, of course. But when I think about young authors or old authors or middle-aged authors or whoever, like, are we going back to that period where it feels like, well, unless I have HarperCollins behind me or Disney Books behind me or whoever, I really shouldn't attempt to put this out as a self-published piece on Kindle because I'm not going to win any awards and I'm not going to sell any books and it's not really worth my time. So I could get it out there, but, you know, the future of TV is TV, right? The future of selling a best-selling book is getting on a bestseller list. And that takes
right. Well, but
having a publishing deal, that, you know, through a big house
requires usually that what you're talking about because like it has to do with the specific amount of time and how many books you sell in like that 1 week period or whatever, and it has to be like the most for the week or whatever. But like, I feel like there's a difference in what's going on in the publishing world now that we have the internet. And yes, there's like a glut of like stuff that is not ready and that shouldn't be out there yet because it needs a lot more work. And yes, there's a lot of stuff that's not going to ever be recognized by like the establishments that already exist. But the point for me and the thing that I love about this age of publishing that we're in is that you can find readers anywhere now because you have this access to them on the web. And so you don't need the Hugo Awards to be able to have a vibrant community of people who are interacting with the things that you write and the stories that you want to tell. So like, it just depends on what you, how you define an author, how you define success, whether best-selling author is the thing that you want or whether consistently attracting readers to your universe that you've created is what you're looking for. So like, yeah.
That's beautiful.
I feel like it's still growing pains and the Hugos maybe made a mistake in allowing their voting structure to continue the way that it has because it's so easy to game as it's been proven a couple of times now. So.
Well, we just need to realize like along the lines of what you're saying, that beautiful chaos of all of these ideas and thoughts and songs and snippets that shouldn't really be published, but they're published, you know, in a way that chaotic stuff is, you know, kind of a beautiful orchestra of creativity, but it also gives rise to the worser parts of humanity, you know, and the baser parts of humanity, especially from us, you know, white males who feel threatened by all these crazy changes in society. And right. So and I guess that's what I'm trying to say is like, not only are the economic pressures there, but then you have, you know, this movement to tell people of color or females or transgender writers, shut up. We don't want to hear your stories. Don't make them political. Don't make them about you. We want to have, you know, cool spaceships in space going pew, pew, pew. You know, we don't want to hear about, you know, what the politics of a 24th century culture dealing with, you know, transgender normatives would be like.
The ironic part is they don't have to.
And
there's room for everybody.
That's what I'm saying. If it's a good enough story and it's authentic and it's honest, like, people aren't going to care if there's a homosexual character in it.
Right, but it's the same thing with Trump. When you see what you thought is your power base slipping away.
Right, but then that creates inauthentic art. That's inauthentic. And you try to hold on to something that you think existed.
You're saying this as a Christian pastor? Like, someone who lives in the world of inauthentic relationships.
Yes.
Constantly.
Do you see the decline in churches? I mean, we can do a whole show on that, but this is why. Because people are trying to hold on to their power, and in trying to hold on to their power, they're losing the heart of the message and the authentic story that is possible in religion.
Well, but and also they're shutting down voices that need to be there. And I think that, to me, that's the real sin. Right, exactly. So we need...
And challenging, and...
Yeah, I mean, good gosh. I'm trying to read The Third Body Problem right now by... Let me grab it.
Okay, ask him how many times he's ripped the headphones out of my ears. A lot.
This is in Lou, and, you know, The Three Body Problem is a book that was a sci-fi book from China that...
Yes.
Made it over here in the United States after 6 years of being in heavy production in China. And it actually won the best book last year for the Hugos. And it's a very challenging book as... Oops, our puppies are here. It's a very challenging book as an English reader because it is in translation. And it has to do with alien interactions where the aliens come down and lo and behold, they don't go to the United States first. There's no Will Smith character. They go to China first because... You know, in that culture, China is right the center of the world. So it's, you know, really plays from a Western point of view. It plays with a lot of those preconceptions, just like any book that I'm.
Man in a Glass Castle. High Castle. What's it called?
What is
that show?
Yeah, Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
Well, it was a book or a short story by Philip K. Dick.
That shifts your perspective. Like, what if this had happened?
Yeah, but it's still that was still like, you know, the Western world. Like, this is. You know, thinking from the East. I hit your headphones again. Sorry. You know, so I don't know. I think I'm excited about the future of sci-fi for my kids. You know, once we get over this bumpy period.
Especially our girls, they have a place in it.
They have a place in it, and they'll be able to experience it in a way that I don't. Yeah, I'm trying to listen to music that's, you know, from around the world now. I'm trying to listen to different... voices. I'm trying to, you know, expose myself to different ideas because I've realized at my old age that
your old age,
you know, I'm reading too much you know, old white man stuff and listening to too much old white man stuff, and I don't want to be that guy when I'm 50 who says, ah, let's make America great again.
You also don't want your kids to be like, you're so old.
Well, I mean, there's that too.
But it does happen because once you and I both got out of the classroom, we kind of realized, oh, we have no connection to today's youth.
And that's the beauty of the Kindle and the internet and not having cable and not watching TV. Like, we don't participate in mainstream culture, but then again, we listen and we read and we do self-affirming and kind of belly button looking.
Navel gazing, is that what you're
trying? You know, like we look at our own belly buttons. Navel gazing, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Navel gazing, there you go.
Happy hour.
I got ya.
Anyway. Yeah.
Well, here's to the future. It may look like it's going down in flames, but it
cheers.
Shall not.
It shall not. That shall not pass.
It shall not, because where there are three people who come together and say, it is so, it is so.
All right.
Not yet.
Did y'all talk about what you're reading?
Not yet.
Okay.
Okay, we'll put yours. Okay,
let me just put one on there.
The three-bodied problem.
Okay, we're gonna so put many that two on books. Three-bodied problem.
That, I know. So go for it.
I am. Go read Ancillary Justice.
I put it in my.
A great degree. Book. Don't I'm type yet. I'll put it on there. Oh my god. You're killing me, Smalls. Killing me, Smalls. And you're not even typing correctly.
Yes, I'm just doing it just to bother you. Spacebar, spacebar, spacebar.
All right, so Ancillary Justice. Also, I just finished a kind of a fun, easy level scientific book called Your Inner Fish, an overview of the human body over the last 3.5 billion years. And it's all about, you know, how fish bones became our bones and the connectedness of us with things like prehistoric sharks. And yeah, it's so good. I'll put a link in the show notes, but, yeah, it's fun. It takes 3 hours to read, and it's, you know, it's like a 250 word book, like, word page book, not word. That would be a really short book.
That's not a book. That's not a novella.
Yeah. But he's a paleontologist, who wrote it, and, it's fantastic. Anyway, so read those three books, and then I'll talk to you next week.
Love you, guys.
Thank you so much for including me.
So, Mariana, what are you reading?
Well, obviously, I just finished Madeline Lingle's Walking on Water, which is very good. And then I'm reading Eric Larson's Thunderstruck. You know, he wrote Devil and the Right.
No, not yet.
Have you read? You haven't read any of his, have you? Much in the style of
Lusitania? No. Titanic?
Devil in the White City.
That was Chicago.
Yes. Well, Chicago World's Fair.
What was the boat thing?
What was the boat thing?
About the Lusitania?
Yeah, what was it called? But I read that one too.
Why don't you knock on your keyboard some more?
So this is the one that I told you that I found in the Barnes Noble bag that I almost bought again. Nice. So I'm in the midst of that as well.
I have picked up, which I started and then put down and walked away from for a little while because I got busy with other things. But I picked up Steal the Sky by Megan O'Keefe, and I'm reading that right now. I met her at a local author event recently. She was signing books because it's her debut novel. And so I'm kind of excited to actually read this story and chew on the world building that she has going on in there. Very excited. Yeah,
I know her. So that makes it even better.
And she's going to be at a barbecue that I think I have to miss.
It's always better to read a signed book.
I'm doing a write-in with my homies instead of, you know. Yes.
Barbecuing. It's always better to read a book that has been signed than a book that has been signed. It is true. Well, wow.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a long show for us. That's what you get. Also, because we missed last week, so playing catch up here a little bit.
Yep. Nope, I think.
So anything else you want to add?
I'm glad we had a chance to talk about stuff.
So keep working on your drafts.
And that's okay. It's not a manuscript yet. That's really okay. Don't feel like keep that working. Makes it less. It doesn't make it less.
Yeah, mine's not a manuscript yet.
Not quite.
Is yours a manuscript yet? Not quite. So keep working on it because we are too.
So keep revising.
Keep writing, keep even if you're only halfway there. Bye.